The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Okay, this is Mike Consul, one of the editors here at Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. And sitting a world away from me, through the miracle of the internet, is Kurt Edwards. He is a part of the real estate research and strategy team for U.S. real estate at UBS Asset Management. Let's call it U.S. real estate and private markets. That's the unit that you operate within, I believe, Kurt.
You
also lead the investment analytics team, which creates advanced analytics to enhance the investment process and portfolio strategy, as well as serving on the firm's performance measurement and reporting committee, blah, blah, blah. bios are always boring most of the time. If they've gone to the same college as I have, then we got something to talk about. But we're going to talk data today because Kurt is swimming in data. And he's actually one of those guys who's excited about this data. This is data about real estate. Is data that enhances his ability to manage and construct portfolios and ultimately bring out better performance, one would hope. Otherwise, why do we have these guys sitting in rooms playing with data? Well, Kurt's going to answer these questions. So first of all, Kurt Edwards, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks to the IREI. I think you put on a fine podcast. And so very excited to be here. And you're right. There's no shortage of acronyms within the real estate industry. So you're right. Real estate and private markets, we always usually call REPO. And sometimes I need to be reminded of that. So thanks, Mike.
And Kurt has promised me he's not going to get wonky on us. He's going to keep this at a level that he's not going to get into the minutiae, and he's going to make us understand why this is important. So Kurt, let me start with just based on some of the advance notes you sent over that I received from you, the real estate business has seen this explosion of data, like so many other industries. And this data is at investors and operators' disposal. Let's start with how it's being collected. What are the sources of this data? And then you can maybe take off from there as to what effect it's having.
Sure. Yeah, Mike, I mean, you're exactly right. Big data is coming for real estate, full stop. I mean, whether you like it or not, either you use it and try to perform well in the market, or you're not using it at all, and you're just trying to say real estate's a relationship game, and that's all it is. I bet that you have a very high probability of underperforming going into the future. So certainly, it's an important topic. Some parts of the world, it's well understood. Some parts, it's not. So that's a very big part of my job, is to make sure we create awareness, education. We have impact with the data and tools that we make. So let's dive right into it, right? So you were talking about, where do we get this data from?
Well, yeah. Is it automated? Is it collected through artificial intelligence? Is it something is it a system that is self-sustaining and channels this tremendous torrent of information to your desktop?
Well, the good news is real estate's not the only industry using data. And so there's a lot of overlap between industries on different types of data, right? So I'll start with primary sources first, right? So the primary sources of data that we can collect are just on our own properties, right? If you think about it, over 30 years, while some investment managers have had portfolios and properties, they've been collecting financial data through their general ledgers, through their on-site teams. That could be operational data as well, like vacancy. All the typical things you're used to seeing within real estate, we have at our disposal right now. And not only that, we can now connect those primary sources to secondary sources. So because there are so many industries going after alternative data, per se, we're not the only one. So we have a bunch of aggregators coming to our disposal, right, to say, we can help you curate alternative data we can help you with your objectives on some of your models to figure out what data would be most helpful. And, you know, some of it's paid and some of it's in the public domain. So a good example of that is, you know, if you were to think about how retailers end up using foot traffic information, you know, in the past, it's been done by a person sitting at a mall and with a little counter, right? And they would write in a little piece of paper, they would submit it in, and that's how you get the data. Well, that's gone out the door these days, right? There's Internet of Things or sensors within these retailers that they can show what the occupancy is in real time, right? They can see who's coming in. And not only that, Mike, they can use phones as well for mobile tracking. Certainly there's identification that's masked, so you shouldn't be worried too much that they know exactly who you are, although who knows what's out there. I know NSA and everything is a little bit scary out there, but we certainly don't
deal with that. There's a certain Big Brother aspect to it as well. I can see some people getting a little squeamish.
Right. No, that's exactly right. So we need to be very careful with the ethics of how we use data and which data providers we do use on that and that kind of framework. So for instance, there are databases out there for mobile pinging technology where, you know, if you think about the apps that you use, you are agreeing if it's open in the background that every so often those cellular towers will ping that phone. And then, you know, the likes of Uber technologies, not the Uber car, but a certain company that aggregates a lot of this information, then makes that available for multiple industries to use for different aspects. So that's just an example of how alternative this data can be. And then we can understand, you know, is there cross shopping, you know, in a retail space or not? So there's mobile pinging, and then there's also MasterCard, right? There's the likes of MasterCard, American Express. There's some very interesting things that they're doing with their information. So for instance, at this point, if you were trying to create an impact fund, right, a fund that you're saying, we're going to measure the impact of our real estate investment. Well, now you can go after alternative data that like MasterCard could provide about talking about the transactions in a very localized community, right? So it used to be, look, maybe you can get a submarket, maybe you get a metro level of data, but now they can say within, you know, a block of where you're investing, how has the block improved? Like, how has it evolved over time through your real estate investment in some of the buildings around there? So it's kind of exciting. You get to see.
Oh, I see. So some of this data is not just, you're not talking about energy usage. You're not talking about just intra-building data collection. You're talking about market, sub-market collection, or even sub-sub-market collection.
Right.
As to where you're able to, would you be using this data, for example, to kind of suss out whether or not a submarket would sustain an office building or a mixed-use retail complex or so on? Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, certainly using that along with what they call open maps. So when you go onto Yelp, for instance, and you go on Yelp and you start to see all the reviews of restaurants around the way, they're using something in the infrastructure called Open Maps. And so that's kind of a data set where, you know, it's geolocated. You can start to see what restaurants are around there. You can pull information to see what trends are happening with the reviews. A very hyper localized sense of analysis on site selection, also the impact around that area if you were to invest in certain ways.
Well, let's say you use that data and you decide this submarket will sustain this project we want to do, so we're going to go in there with it. Then there's the build period. I mean, you have to get your permits and all that. So in the meantime, if another organization is running, is analyzing much of the same data, and they decide at the same time, oh yeah, this submarket will sustain this project, and it's another office project or another multifamily project, how do you prevent colliding with somebody else's project? They don't even know that you're in progress necessarily, or do you have a means for protecting against that?
Well, I think Mike, that's the beauty of this industry. Just because you have data and just because you can create analysis doesn't mean everyone's going to interpret it the same, doesn't mean everyone's going to execute on it the same, right? So let's say that you have the best data in the world, and let's say you had a prediction that was 100% correct. Just by human nature and human error and how they interpret, how they use that information, do they have all the components in place in their investment process to actually make that project work? That's a toss-up, right? So that's where, you know, we talk a lot about data. We've talked about where we get the data. We can talk about how we analyze it, but like, as you said, I don't want to bore the audience here. But, you know, a lot of what our job is now is to ensure that we have honed in on where to use us in the investment process. Do we have the building blocks in place in our investment process to execute on that office development and ensure its success?
What does the data say about, now this is a stretch for you, what does the data say about people returning to the office? Is there any data out there that helps you prophesize to what level they'll come back? And a lot of talk about hybrid office, but this is human nature now coming into play, I imagine. So the data can't account for us wacky human beings all the time.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, when you have some really big events like the pandemic, I mean, that has rippled across many of the models and analysis that we have internally, but then also what I've seen from some of our vendors as well. It is funny, like when you talk about, you know, what kind of interaction does there need to be in some of these models? And of course, we like to be as hands-off as much as possible, but, you know, there's got to be some assumptions made. There's got to be some qualitative adjustments. And so when you have a big crisis or year or some period of data that just seems to be such a big outlier, that's really difficult to involve or incorporate into our models and then ensure that they're still running correctly, right? That we're still getting significance in the prediction. So getting back to you, do you think, you know, we'll ever go back into the office and at what rate? You know, that's something where I feel like we certainly have a lot of our on-site have different technologies and sensors to understand, you know, what the occupancy is currently, you know, in real time. And what we've seen the trends, especially within like New York, for instance, if it's increasing or not. You know, look, I think at this point, sometimes we think about this in more of a macro research call where it's, we know there's going to be some marginal effect, right? It's not going to be a black or white thing. Not everyone is going to stay away from the office. But marginally, yeah, there's going to be a different way of working. And so I think understanding how we're connected and how we work and what technology we're using to stay connected, I think is very, very important. Very important.
So the data, you can use that data that you're collecting submarkets, sub-submarkets to figure out whether a project will pencil or not or has a prospect of succeeding. Are you also using it then to manage portfolios of properties? Is that also part of what you do with the data?
Yeah, look, Mike, I think you're hitting on something that is a majority of my job. So yes, it's cool to create a shiny new tool to talk about very small exercises like we did a little bit before, where it's like, okay, we can use some alternative data to help us with an office site location for development. But in the bigger scheme of things, especially within the investment management industry, I think the lower hanging fruit is not necessarily that, the site selection. I think the lower hanging fruit is, how is it used within an investment process? How are we checking our biases? When you think about, you know, some investment managers are 200 employee plus, right? So when you start to think about all those employees, there's certainly going to be some systematic bias eventually within that culture, within that investment process. So exactly to your point, we're collecting data and especially performance data. So you think about performance, now we're talking about returns, getting to the heart of what this industry is really about for our pensioners. I think that is where we can use data to correct our biases within the investment process and then create a feedback loop. I mean, that's really the most important thing, right? It's like, how do you know you're enhancing your decision, Mike, if you don't have a feedback loop? Like, where's your baseline? Like, okay, Mike, you've been doing pretty well, you know, returning 10%, you know, per year. That's amazing. But then how do we know you're getting better? You know, how do we know that the market isn't changing in a way where your investment thesis is no longer valid? You know, so I think that's actually more of the meat of what we like to do within our team.
Well, how do you figure that out? You're running numbers. Yeah. You're taking the data. You're running the numbers. I'm not asking you to get into the mathematics of it all, but you're saying you can do that. You can take the bias out of it. You can figure out whether the performance, although on the surface it looks terrific, whether or not it's actually sustainable or maybe starting to trend behind where it should be.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, look, I know you and I had a little bit of a conversation about this before the podcast, but you know, attribution is something that hopefully most of the people that listen to this podcast have been aware of. You know, certainly within the stock and fixed income side, it's been around for 20 years plus. You know, so attribution is simply the exercise of saying against your benchmark, right? Whatever that benchmark might be, let's cut it up into ways of showing how you've actually added value versus that benchmark. And so that goes all the way down to, for instance, let's just say, let's make a real life example, right? And I'm not certainly using any of our specific funds, but just across the investment management industry. Let's say you're an investment manager and you said, okay, this attribution report for the last 3 years says that I outperformed in industrial, right? Or I outperformed against my benchmark because I had a higher level of industrial exposure. Okay, well, I might go to that investment manager and go, well, did you actively mean to do that 3 years ago? Did you look at your benchmark? And did you go, hey, I'm going to load up on industrial because I know it's going to be better? Well, if you did, perfect. That's actual alpha. But if you didn't, that's accidental alpha, right? So it's like, well, now we know that investment manager doesn't necessarily have the skills to make sure that they can continue that positive alpha going forward. So you have this framework of attribution performance measurement, right? It's exploded onto the scene in real estate. But now we're dealing with a lot of accidental alpha. So now what we do is we try to, as a team, go through our investment process, try to understand who owns the investment decision, right? And if you think about real estate, there's a lot of investment decisions. It's not just like, hey, what building you buy? It's, hey, if you bought that building, how did you occupy it? How did you lease it up? Who decides who goes in there and how well their leasing is going? And then even more than that, who decides to sell the building? Is that a portfolio management decision? Is that an asset management decision? Is transactions involved anywhere in there? So you, real quick, you can start to see this investment process for real estate is intricate and it's big, it's large. But if you hone in on who is making the investment decision, that's what you can connect to feedback loops, right? So you can say asset management, right? You own the decision of leasing, right? You're solely owning leasing for this building. Okay, well, now that we know that, where's your baseline for that? How well have you done in the past with leasing this? And guess what? If we find out that you've done pretty well, okay, well, how do we enhance that even more? So we can hone in on that and say, asset manager, now that you own this decision, help us make an enhancement tool using all this alternative data that we talked about before, where we can actually follow and track that you've done better, you know, in your leasing. And so that all kind of culminates up through the investment process into the portfolio, as you mentioned, and we can track that performance at an aggregate level across the firm. So I think that's a super exciting area of analytics for investment management.
So let's say you've got a very hot property type like industrial. And of course, people, of course, who are investing in industrial, they want to be on guard about when does this turn? When has the thread run and it starts to lose some of its locomotion? So you would typically follow things like absorption rate. You'd look at lease fees. You'd look at, you know, how e-commerce may be starting to slow down to top out. Some economic indicators are saying there's going to be a slowdown. All of these things existed before this explosion of data. Using industrial as an example, what would all these new strands of data bring to the table that you didn't already have 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, it does help try to understand the trends of, is it going up? Is it going down? Whether we're talking about pricing, occupancy, absorption, what have you. I think the harder thing is, once you have all of that information, is making it relative, right? And so it kind of goes back to us in our conversation talking about correcting biases within the investment process. So what I would say is, like, for instance, we might have some transactions. People say, you know, it's very expensive price per pound. In fact, I don't know if I've ever seen it be so expensive price per pound on industrial. So therefore, I'm fearful, right? Like, I'm fearful that we should just stop buying completely, right? If you would have done that 3 years ago, you would have lost out on an incredible opportunity. And people were saying that 3 years ago, you know, across the investment management community. They're going, wow, I've never seen this. Because again, it's what is their observation? You know, for the last 30 years, if you've been a transactions person, you haven't had a lot of pricing, relative pricing information across the nation, right? And so you're good at what you do in your specific markets a lot of times because you see the price per pound. And then you carry that forward into today's realm where we have a lot more information to say, actually, you might think it's super expensive, but if we look at the relative yields, if you look at the pricing and what we're getting in other asset classes, what we're getting in other sectors, and then we assess the risk, and that's where, gosh, I can tell you, Mike, look, I know I'm getting a little bit too excited about this, but the risk is another area which is really exciting because we say, gosh, how do we measure the risk in industrial? Do we start to look at truck terminals? Do we start to look at the trucking patterns? You know, you can actually start to get some data from the departments of transit in different states on how many trucks go through in areas and how many nodes are being built up and how much of them have growing traffic versus less traffic. So that's where we can start to incorporate some of those risk factors, I'll say, into, okay, well, you know, the pricing you think, maybe when I say you, just the, you know, general transaction person, right? The pricing seems really high. The relative pricing across the asset classes, okay, maybe it's somewhat attractive, but actually the risk is pretty low. We're looking at the e-commerce penetration in the area. You know, so that's one metric as well that's very useful. What is the penetration in retail sales in the area of e-commerce? So it's another risk factor. You know, if it's growing and it's actually showing that its momentum is growing as well, then the risk should be less and less, and you should be willing to pay up more for that then.
Is this another one of those situations where the big organizations, the UBSs of the world, can afford the data and the people to process it, and it gives them a distinct advantage over the mid-size or small players in the field?
You know, only for so long, I would say that, you know, simply you would say yes, but as that becomes more valuable, you have other organizations that carve out, that become boutiques in providing outsourced services that we're building internally. But I can tell you right now, Mike, I mean, we're even using some outsourced services or looking to use some outsourced services because simply, you know, you can never have enough data scientists in my mind, but, you know, that's just a constraint. You can't have the whole organization be data scientists because, look, we're only half of what I think the investment process is, not even maybe. You know, if you think about real estate 10 years ago even, I would say the use of data analytics within your investment decision making is probably only 10%. I know it sounds kind of crazy, and I know it's certainly gut feel on my own call right here, but, you know, just in my experience, it was really kind of just 10%. And now what we're trying to strive for is that it's just half, you know, like use it to correct your biases again. So just half of your investment decision, look at all the analytics that is being created, look at the data. And so the other half is still, you know, the qualitative, you know, relationship-based execution experience. And that means a lot, right? So when you're talking about the advantage of using data versus not, certainly I think there is an advantage, but it's how you use it. It's how you incorporate it into your investment process. So look, I think, yes, the bigger organizations have proprietary information because of their history that will give them a leg up. But I'm not so sure it's going to be that black and white, that it's only big institutions. They'll just keep on gobbling up the data because of their resources and then use it in a way to just consolidate the industry. I might be wrong, but it's just kind of my thoughts on that.
So the better data, better returns, is that going to be the scenario? And it's hard to believe, to me, it's hard to believe that we're going to continue to collect more data and refine that data to the point where returns just grow and grow. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a point of diminishing returns. There's also people who argue that, you know, too much data is not a good thing, that people get buried in data, and there tends to be data collection for the sake of having data, and not that the data is really telling. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying about that? There's data that actually tells you something, tells a story. Then there's data that's data, but it is not really telling So what about that? Talk about how you need to guard against, because you're obviously an enthusiastic guy when it comes to data. This is your channel. And you could, you know, it might not be you, Kurt, but somebody else who's enthusiastic as you could end up getting intoxicated with the sheer volume of stuff and kind of lose sight of the fact that it's almost like a portfolio that's got so many different pieces within it that you don't really know what's working and what isn't working. So you have to clarify it.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I got to tell you, one of the most pivotal moments in my career was when we worked on a project using, and look, I won't go too far into these mundane, you know, minutiae detailed analysis, but there is a type of machine learning model called random forest, right? And so what that will do is effectively make multiple decision trees and then figure out which collection of decision trees are best used together for a prediction, right? To classify something. And there's ways that you can interpret it as a human. And so when I started my career, everything was in Excel. We were putting things together, we're saying, well, what do we threw this variable in? You know, what if we take it out? What if we threw this in? And there's ways to do what us data people call dimensionality reduction, which I won't go into it, but it's a way of saying what variables matter most, you know, for your prediction. And when you started using machine learning, it just blew my mind, Mike, because it basically just made me sit back and go, I don't know if I can ever trust now a human deciding which variables are important, because humans can only ever conceptualize four variables at a time. Right. There was like an article out of Psychology Journal in 2005 kind of proving that. And then if you think about adding dimensions to it now, if we're like talking about over time, cutting it in different ways, looking at different trends, it's way less than four variables that the human mind can conceptualize. So that is kind of what made me realize that, you know, when we're putting these worksheets together without using machine learning, it's kind of like, you know, it's very hard to understand how that can impact and what the significance is to your decision making. So bringing it back to what you're talking about with this deluge of information and data, I totally agree. And even more so, then we need to use these new techniques within machine learning to help us make sense of, with all this data, what really matters, because there's no way we can go through thousands of variables. I mean, that would take someone an ungodly amount. I mean, there's just no way. But with machine learning, we can throw thousands of variables at it. We can help interpret why it picks certain variables and just say, okay, well, let's test it out, right? Let's back test this to see if it would have worked 10 years ago or if it would have worked 5 years ago, knowing what we know now. And that's when you kind of do some randomized back testing to see if the model really works. And then you create a little bit of a feedback loop for their own model going forward to say, is it still working the way that we think it should be working? So kind of going back to your point, it is dangerous. It's kind of like I used to say 30 years ago, I feel like real estate was the wild, wild west. And now we're being more civilized. Well, I bet you in 30 years, they're going to look back at data science and analytics and go, that was wild, wild west. There's just so much data being thrown around. But I think that's where you get an industry being created for these curators of data. Right. So when I was talking early on about primary and secondary sources of data, well, some of those secondary sources of data come with aggregators and curators where we will work with them to say, this model's objective is X. Can you help us understand if this data set is right for this model? Let's test it. Let's work together and let's work through that to see if we have the right information. So that's becoming a whole industry on its own, Mike. It's been pretty amazing to see that.
So what is the data telling you about multifamily? When is that thread going to run out? I'm asking a question maybe you can't even answer. You might not be allowed to answer that question. But it doesn't have to be multifamily. Is there anything that you can say the data is pointing to this right now that you can say without running afoul of your compliance people? I don't know if that's possible or not.
Well, look, we certainly don't see any information saying that multifamily is going to be done at any time, right? It is a necessity for our society given the supply constraints on single family homes, even though I know those are starting to be built up. Look, like any cycle, like any sector, there's going to be changes. You need to stay in front of what those changes are, whether that be unit sizes, whether that be how the leases are structured, whether that be how apartments are built, So those are all factors that, you know, certainly no one model can tell all, you know. So you, again, this comes back to the kind of the qualitative and interpretation bent of absolutely, we can create models, macro models to help us with that specific question. And even then, it's like, you got to make that question a little bit more specific, but I take it we're on a podcast. So, you know, I'm happy to talk in generalities, but, you know, I think the data is showing us some interesting things about how we can use them within multifamily. Like if you look at some of the new tech startups on multifamily, it's pretty amazing what they're able to do with, you know, self-guided tours, sensing how many tours there are, figuring out lead conversions, right? So when you have a person walk through, how often do they sign the lease? And that's data, right? We're talking about data in the macro sense for an investment manager, but I mean, it also is on site. When you say like, can apartments keep going, right? It's like, well, of course, every sector is going to become more efficient because it has to. That's how you compete, right? So these on-site companies are using some of the same data or same models that we would use, but for different purposes. So, you know, I know everyone likes to say there's doom and gloom in some sectors, but it's kind of amazing to see how some sectors can be disrupted by tech at the prop level, and which then creates more cash flow because maybe saved expenses, and then it becomes a good investment again. So that happens all the time, really.
How did you get so involved in data? I mean, where did you go to school and what did you study?
You know, I studied banking and finance in school and then got my master's at UConn, you know, within real estate and finance. But I would say this, I mean, throughout my whole career, it's been about, I was trying to be a sponge, right? Trying to understand why people were making certain decisions that they were, and then how could I understand that decision, right? And so it started at Townsend, right? A consultant. You know, when I first started there, it was, how do we make sure we have consistent amount of information and information sharing across the consultants on certain funds and certain managers? And so it's me working with a programmer to then come up, which I think they still do use this software, but I think it's, of course, it's been developed a little bit more since I've been there. Gosh, it's been, I guess, maybe 10 years now or more than that. You know, so we built a software to basically do that, collect all the notes, collect all the performance information, collect all the data, put it in one spot that can connect per consultant, per client, and per fund. So you can make those interconnections of, well, how many clients do we have in this fund? You know, how many managers are out there? You know, how many closed-end funds in this strategy are there? So that kind of got me excited about what we can do with information at the consultant level. And then UBS has a very good research team. Tiffany Gerlone heads it up at this point. And they got me very interested in how they use information on macro calls. So I kind of felt like it was a good fit. And that's when I went over to UBS and started down the line of, wow, now that I have primary source information, you know, it's not fund managers sending it to me. It's now we own the properties and we can dig into the property's general ledger. That kind of excited me a little bit more just to kind of go down that route to see what can we do with ARGUS models, for instance? What can we do with appraisal information? What can we do with our general ledger and accounting information and on-site operational information? So as you can tell, as a data person, you know, it was a treasure trove of information that we can exploit. So that got me all the way to where I am today, where now, yes, I've created those shiny new toys. Now we just need to know how to use them the best and create most impact off of those shiny new toys.
So the era of big data, how far can it go? I mean, where do you see it going in the next 5 or 10 years, Kurt? I mean, do you have a clear vision on that? Is this going to be basically blowing our minds in 5 or 10 years, or is it going to take longer than that to develop more fully?
I think it's going to have to prove itself. You know, I think right now, as we've discussed, it's difficult among the investment process to get buy-in on some of this data because, look, you need to educate and create awareness around what is this, why are we using it, why is it so important? And I'd say that's the next 2 to 3 years maybe, which I know is a very short time frame. And maybe that's because of my own experience, really, and so I don't want to talk for others in the data science world. But
will it prove itself? Are you betting that is your prediction that it's going to prove to be a? It is okay.
Absolutely.
After which, people will trust the data that much more.
yeah, there's going to be a little bit more buying. I mean, we see it within our own firm right now, Mike. I mean, it used to be my group was the only group that created dashboards, that used data, that was very data savvy, that cared about the interpretation of the data, that integrity and governance. It's now people coming out of college right now that we hire have those skills already. Like, they're data savvy. They understand data relationships. They understand why dashboards are so important in honing those dashboards in. So our group internally has almost become a way to supercharge your own data analytics and their own functions, right? So it's now growing outside of just our group into other groups, which then gives me a lot of like hope, you know, that, yeah, this is definitely not going away. This is going to grow. And one thing I like to say, Mike, is it's very hard to measure what the ROI on some of these models and analytics and everything is going to be, you know, because people are thinking of positive ROI. And of course, I do believe in positive ROI. I just don't know how far that will go. But I can tell you this. I have seen where if you don't use this information, that ROI can go negative, right? So it's almost like at this point, a protection, right? It's like using this information will hopefully protect you from making disastrous decisions. But how much will it improve your positive decisions? You know, I don't know. It really depends on the example, right? It depends on the scenario. And I think that's what's difficult is to say, look, I don't want to be a propagator of fear. I don't want to motivate by fear. But I do think that if you don't start to use data analytics within your investment process, it will create more downside exposure for your investment.
Interesting. Our guest has been Kurt Edwards. He is a data analytics guru with UBS Asset Management, and he's out to prove something. And we're all betting with you, Kurt. We want you to prove it because we want better returns, better and better returns.
We want you out there
on the front lines, making sure there's no disasters and that you are able to wring every good dollar out of a real estate project or portfolio that is possible. I appreciate you taking the time, Kurt, I wish you best of luck with these future endeavors, the current and future endeavors. It's interesting that you're really in the process of proving that the data will offer superior performance. We're going to see. We're going to have to have you back in 2 or 3 years for you to either eat humble pie or gloat.
Yeah, so I've eaten humble pie before, so it wouldn't be the first time. But you know what? Like I know that there's opportunities everywhere to make advancements and improve. So that's what I'm focused on.